Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm quite excited today to talk about this book published by Bloomsbury with its author, who we have with us, Dr. Kieran Feil, because the book is investigating, explaining, exploring something that I think, myself included, a lot of us have seen, maybe not in person, but certainly on TV, or at least seen some of, but not really understood what's happening. And this book, thankfully, explains it. So the book pretty much says what it is. It's titled How Language Shapes Relationships in Professional Sports Teams, Power and Solidarity Dynamics in a New Zealand Rugby Team, and looks at things like the kinds of relationships on a sports team, things like the huddles before a match or a game and what's actually happening there. Honestly, I found this absolutely fascinating. So Kieran, I'm so pleased to welcome you to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Miranda, and for that lovely introduction too.
Well, I'm actually going to ask you now to do some introduction. Could you tell us a bit about yourself and explain why you decided to write this book?
Yeah, sure. So I am a sociolinguist, discourse analyst by trade. And my general interest really, well, most sociolinguists are interested in language and how language is used in everyday life. My particular area of interest is how language is used in high-performance sports context. And that's sort of, I guess, part of a broader mission for me is to try and make linguistics a relevant toolkit for high-performance sports teams to turn to answer key sort of social dynamic questions. So that was probably the broader reason why I tackled this particular mission in this book. I also had a lot of really good links to high-performance sports through some of my PhD work as well. So I was able to pursue some of these. Sports teams are quite hard to get into, particularly professional sports teams. You know, certainly if you want to be armed with a video camera and an audio recorder. So with these established relationships and links, I was able to get into some of these spaces and really look at the way language is being used and shine a light on it for others. So those are probably the main reasons why I got into this book. I realize I may not have introduced myself beyond calling myself a sociolinguist. So I might just give a little bit more about that too. I'm a New Zealander, which I suppose, you know, with New Zealand and rugby being so deeply interconnected, this may also make sense. I've come on a real journey to linguistics. I was a language teacher for many years as well. Before that, I did a degree in ancient history and art history, which shows how much you can deviate to find the thing that you're really passionate about. Now I'm actually in a really wonderful place. I'm able to really consult high-performance sports teams and organizations on language use, how to use language use effectively.
Well, thank you for that introduction to the book and to yourself. I think having read the book, kind of hearing that, I'm like, I see all the pieces coming together. That makes a lot of sense. So a very good foundation for our discussion. And sort of building on that, given these interests and, as you said, especially that access to the teams, get the fact that you were able to go in and speak to them, what kinds of questions were you asking in doing that that have become the book, and how did you develop them?
So, yeah. Great questions, because as a qualitative researcher, and you know, your listeners who are qualitative researchers out there will know, these research agendas that you engage in, they sort of emerge as you process the data. And so you can go in with some big, broad ideas about what you might be interested in, but the specifics don't really take shape until you see the data. And that's really key with linguistics work as well. You don't want to go in there with a predefined agenda, because you'll find what you're looking for, but you might also miss a lot of really valuable things that are happening. I went into that project with a bit of a practical mission from the team itself, which was, can you tell me, the coaches really wanted to know, can you tell me a little bit about who my leaders are? can you use linguistics to sort of reverse engineer an understanding of my leadership group? Who's talking, who's not talking, which is equally important. You know, how are the people that are in notional leadership roles behaving? What sorts of opportunities are they offering for other players to step up into leadership? So we had a really practical mission, and that was driven by this belief that there was some disconnect between the coaching team and the playing leadership. So we really wanted to sort of look at how language was being used and whether or not messages were getting onto the field and whether they were being utilized and drawn on by the captain and distributed through the leadership group of the team. And from that, it really ballooned to a bigger question of these social relationships. The leader-follower relationship is one type of relationship, and one way of conceptualizing relationships in sports teams, a really significant one. But there was a lot of nuance in that too, and a lot of different dynamics. So really, the focus on relationships more specifically and the breadth of relationships and the different types of relationships and how they were working, that emerged as the data got processed and as I got to see a lot of nuance in the way language was being used in different dynamics.
Thank you for taking us through that evolution. As you said, it is such a key part of especially qualitative research. Given then how it progressed, what sorts of relationships did you end up examining in the book and how might we conceptualize them?
Yeah, so I think one of the key points of departure for this book was power, and linguists are really interested in power. And that was one of the things that really shone through in the analysis, was how power was working. So we don't really conceptualize relationships, you know, in terms of very abstract things like trust. We look really at how relationships are working, how they're being performed. And power is one of the most useful mechanisms to really shine a light on how power on how relationships are working. So we conceptualize relationships in this book around notion of power, but also solidarity. So for me in this book, power is very much conceptualized as rights and responsibilities in the team. And these rights and responsibilities were performed in and through language, you know, in terms of controlling the agenda, controlling the governance of the team. So that was power, how power was conceptualized, and solidarity was conceptualized much more along the lines of social distance. Now, this is a concept that we use a lot in sociolinguistics to help look for the degree of distance between individuals, and language use is a really useful way of constructing social distance. Now, you probably all have examples of this on a daily basis. There's people who we're really friendly with. You might be people. You might overhear a couple of people speaking in a cafe, and you'd be able to know how close they are to one another based on the language that they're using. At the same time, someone might come and try and be your friend, and you might want to create social distance to get away from them. I'm thinking of a very specific encounter I had yesterday with a door-to-door salesperson who came around and tried to really be my friend for the strategic end of trying to sell me something. I can't even remember what it was now. I was trying to get rid of them. But you use language in these ways to create social distance or to reduce social distance. And that was how we how I conceptualized solidarity in the book.
That's very helpful to understand, both kind of in this specific context and in sort of ways that those of us who are not members of professional sports teams might still be able to relate to. So staying on this idea then of concepts, can you walk us through the conceptual framework you use in the book and the questions around it, and kind of how you developed that way of thinking?
Yeah, so my toolkit is discourse analysis and sociolinguistics, and really the goal there is to go into an environment and collect examples of real language use with the idea of reverse engineering cultural norms, social norms of that environment. So discourse analysis has emerged from a wider field of linguistics. It's much more concerned with actually how language is used in practice. Most of the sort of preceding linguistic theory was very much interested in the theoretical concepts of language and understanding what language was as a sort of a broader toolkit, but not really going into the environments and looking at how language was actually being used. And so, you know, for understanding the issues that humans engage with on an everyday basis, the way they shape their relationships, the way they talk their cultures into being, you know, we needed another toolkit to really help us with that. And that's really what I see the main value of discourse analysis is. It allows us to bring empirical insights from the social world, how language is being used by humans to shape their environments and their cultures and their relationships, and it allows us to shine a light on those. So for this particular mission of this book, which was really trying to understand how relationships work in high performance sports teams, this toolkit really stood out as valuable and useful. But it did require me to sort of find a gatekeeper to get me into these environments. As I mentioned at the beginning, it's quite hard to do that. So, and to build trust with that group of people to try and ensure that I wasn't a distraction on the environment. It's one of the biggest concerns is that you get into an environment and you influence it in a negative way. So all these sorts of things are really important if you really want to capture authentic language use as it is authentic in this particular context. But for the mission, discourse analysis was really the best toolkit. A lot of research has been done already around what people think about relationships, how people think relationships work in high-performance sports teams, but not a lot's been done on how they actually work. And that was why discourse analysis was really valuable to draw on.
Mm. No, and I think that distinction between kind of the theory and the practice is key to keep in mind as well, because obviously you then had to do that, right? You had to apply that conceptual framework and those tools to what you were actually seeing and recording. Can you tell us a bit about kind of practically how you did this?
Practically how I analyzed the data?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure. Again, really emergent process. The first thing you obviously have to do is transcribe the data. So you go in, you go into these environments and you collect the data, first of all. And so that saw me, like you said at the beginning, going into huddles, going to the changing room, collecting putting as many recorders as I possibly could in subtle places that were able to capture all the recording, all the conversations, halftime team talks, pre-match team talks, coach-player interactions, training interactions. Some of the most interesting interactions were on the field, where I ran out onto the field. I had the honorary position of water carrier during the period I was with the team. And that allowed me to get on the field into the huddle and record interactions between the players during stoppages in the match. In rugby, there are a lot of stoppages in the match, so you can get in there and really see who's talking. Taking that data and then trying to create a transcript or record of it allows for the more deeper, fine-grained analysis to take place. So that's the next step, is really turning those audio recordings into something that can be analyzed in depth and that can be used to hone in on the language. So you transcribe it word for word, and you transcribe everything, all the ums, the ahs, the pauses, everything, because little tiny pieces of interactional behavior can be really significant for trying to understand the meaning of those linguistic units. So you've got all these really weird, the discourse analysts that in your audience will know, you've got all these really weird transcripts that are, you know, have a lot of interesting symbols and signs that signify, you know, downward intonation, gaps in seconds, tailing off of talk, latching, all these sorts of kind of complex interactional phenomena. But the idea there is you've got a really clear record that will allow you to, you know, interpret the language as it's being used in that context. Mm. Once you've got the transcript, you then need to ask questions of it. And my questions were very much around power and solidarity. So I started looking closely then for evidence of how power was working, who was in control, who was claiming rights and responsibilities over the interaction. One of the key kind of, I guess, focal points of that is turn-taking. Who's kicking off the interaction? Sorry, excuse the puns. It is a sports book after all. But yeah, who's kicking off the interactions? Who's closing them down? Who's maintaining control over the agenda? Who's inviting or being invited into these interactions? So I was able to look at this in these interactions and try and formulate an understanding of how power was working with respect to the rights and responsibilities being claimed by speakers in these interactions. And the same thing with solidarity. I was able to look at how people were constructing distance between one another or no distance, reducing that distance between one another. What linguistic cues were allowing speakers or showing speakers constructing a closer relationship or closer degree of distance between one another, and what other features were in some other dynamics constructing more distance between certain individuals.
Mm. All right. So I want to get into some of those dynamics now that you've so helpfully laid out for us kind of how we're investigating all of this practically and conceptually. If we look at the idea of coaches and players having an asymmetry of power, obviously, that doesn't come out of nowhere, right? Some of the kind of obvious ones we don't necessarily have. It's not like they're necessarily that much different in age or different in gender, different in all sorts of things. Mm. How are these asymmetrical power dynamics constructed?
That, I mean, to be absolutely upfront, that is one of the key questions of the book. You know, so I've got quite a lot to say about that. I better be careful not to absorb the floor too much here. But yeah, the, you know, those taken for granted communicative mechanisms that establish the sort of cultural order or social order of coaches in control. And some of these things, I'm going to mention a few of them now, but your listeners might be thinking, oh gosh, that's so self-explanatory. But to be honest, it's those, that sort of analysis that allows us to really shine a light on some of these mechanisms. So in the book, in the analysis and in the book, I talk about a number of these mechanisms. One is obviously amount of talk, who's doing the most talking and who's doing the least talking. And dominating the floor is and can be seen as a mechanism of control. Just out of, you know, pure degree of amount of talk. And usually in that talk, that person is doing a lot of control and giving instructions, delivering an agenda, doing most of the assessment of the performance, things like that. So amount of talk was one of the main markers of control. However, there are loads of other more nuanced, and we can look into that too. So, you know, coaches would decide when the team would have a talk and where they would take place. They would decide how long the talk would progress for, when it would end and how it would end, whether anyone else was invited to speak or in most cases they were not, or they were asked any questions at the end. They would always, there was a lot of issuing of a non-negotiable, largely sort of unidirectional agenda for the team. There was evidence of coaches being the only ones who gave instructions, particularly in coach-player interactions. When it came to assessing performance, and this was probably one of the more interesting ones for me, it was the coaches' assessments that were predominant in the team settings. So it's almost like sort of saying that it was the coaches' opinion on the performance that really mattered and was really significant. So that was another way that power was enacted. I think whenever the coach talked in these interactions, they would position the players mainly as recipients of whatever the coach had to say, their instructions, their assessments. They weren't really constructed as parties capable of jointly shaping an agenda or jointly shaping an assessment. assessment of performance. They were mainly there to receive the coach's wisdom. They control the topic of talk. And, you know, one element of this too is that when they did invite the players to talk, they usually gave them a topic a topic to talk about, as opposed to raising their own topics in these sort of team settings. And, of course, they exercised control over who else talked. And they sanctioned those individuals too by giving them spaces. But not everyone had that right. There was only certain individuals, usually only the captain.
So, in fact, that's what I'd like to ask you about. Obviously, it's worth highlighting again that the answer you just gave is essentially the highlights version, given how core it is to the book. But I think it does help give us at least an overview of some of the things. Of course, the book has loads more detail for listeners who want to get into that. But talking about this idea of kind of what things the coaches do and don't sanction, can we talk a bit about the kind of construction of the role of team captain, and perhaps especially through the tool that you've not mentioned as much so far, the use of questions?
Questions were, really interesting. Questions have been one of those linguistic features, I think, that have received a little bit of attention from linguists, but also from sort of coaching researchers from other disciplines. Questions are one of those things that's seen as driving a coach's agenda. Just to speak generally about the questions, first of all, as a backdrop to the discussion about the captain-coach relationship, the way I analysed questions was to look at the form and the function of the questions, and then try and categorize these forms and functions as to in relation to the different purposes that the coach was trying to achieve and through these questions. And from that perspective, we were able to really probe the identity of the coach that they were trying to construct, because questions are really versatile, flexible, communicative resource, and we can shape them in a range of different ways that allow us to present ourselves as more or less in control, more or less supportive, more or less of a motivator or a friend or someone who's in greater control over others. So there was some really interesting nuance, and I found evidence of the coach constructing themselves as sort of four main identity characteristics. There was the coach as educator, there was the coach as chief problem solver, there was the coach as sheriff, or, the boss, and then the coach as motivator. And so with regards to educator, you saw the coach asking a lot of questions that would ask the players to provide a piece of information or knowledge that was missing, or that the coach thought was missing, just to sort of see whether that information was distributed and shared across the group. So a lot of questions that were, do you see what's wrong here? These sorts of questions where the players would go, oh, we haven't supported the ball carrier. Yes, that's right. So we've got to fix that. So that was sort of the coach's educator questions, took that form a lot. Then there were questions that were used to sort of initiate and coordinate problem solving episodes. So that was the sort of identity of the coaches, the chief problem solver. They would embed issues within their questions that needed to be addressed. Then there were questions that were much more direct and forceful, which were the questions that coaches asked to sometimes face threatening ways to hold players accountable for mistakes that they were making in face threatening ways. So lots of things like, who was at fault here? What happened here? These sorts of questions that were much more face threatening and encouraged players to sort of admit faults so that the team could benefit from that and learn. And then there were other questions that were much more provocative, where the coach was using questions strategically to motivate, sort of thing. Do you think this is the best we can do? These sorts of questions where the players would then respond, in a strong way, say, no, we can do more. So the coach was using questions in a much more flexible way. I think with regards to the captain and coach relationship, questions were, I guess, one aspect of that relationship, how that worked. But most of the way that relationship was worked was mainly on a distributed basis. So the coach would distribute some responsibilities to the captain to allow them to perform a leadership role. They'd have to sanction those responsibilities, and they would usually be there in the huddles or in the team settings at the same time. So they were overseeing that as well, and they would also sanction what the captain had to say, and they would talk a little bit more in advance what the captain had said, and they would say whether it was right or wrong. So they were always overseeing that. So that relationship was, you know, very structured in its own right. That hierarchy very much had the coach at the top and the captain a very distant second.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's really interesting to think about, as you said, how flexible questions can be, and therefore how much more interesting it is to examine kind of how they're being used. Mm. We've talked a bit so far about kind of the more hierarchical side of the interactions you examine and analyze. Can you talk a bit about some of the times where you saw much flatter hierarchies? When do those come up, and kind of what's significantly different about them?
Yeah, the only time I saw flatter hierarchies, and I think this is a really key feature of the cultural context of coaching. When the coach and players were together, there was always a highly elevated hierarchy. When the coach was not present was the only time I saw a more distributed set of responsibilities and roles across the group. So take the coach out of the picture, the players, I guess, felt more comfortable talking. So I think I mentioned a little bit early on that there were situations where I was able to get out onto the field as in my sort of honourable role as water carrier in the team. Those were the situations where I saw a much flatter structure being enacted. And that was enacted by multiple individuals contributing to the governance of the team, you know, contributing instructions to other people. In the coach-player relationship chapters, we saw it was the coach who controlled all the instructions and delivered all the assessments of performance, required things of other people. But when we went out to the field and the coach wasn't present, we saw multiple players engaged in this activity and this behavior. And it might be that that's because, you know, the game was underway, and they're all playing in their positions and they all need to coordinate one another. And so that potentially shows a team operating in a high performing fashion where multiple individuals are contributing to the governance of the team, locating problems, seeking to address them, and also players willing to be addressed and instructed. So it wasn't just the captain who took over the role of the coach. We saw a much flatter structure there where, in my data at least, we saw young players who were in their first season talking. And that was sometimes the first time I'd heard them talk at all. In some cases, I'd been with the team for a week, I remember, and in some of these voices, I was like, who's that? I hadn't heard them talk at all. And, you know, suddenly they were piping up in the huddles on the field. So that was obviously an area where there was a flatter structure, and it may be explained by the fact that, you know, that's the game. We all need to contribute to coordinate our team activity. I think in a coach player environment, you know, I only have data from one team, and certainly what I don't want to give the impression that, you know, enacting control is wrong. There are a lot of people out there, coaches, who are starting to think a little bit about whether that power relationship serves their purposes in a coaching environment. So, you know, a flatter hierarchy is probably going to need to be enacted at a very deep cultural level. It's a cultural decision. Certainly in my team context, I didn't see that. That's not to say it's not wrong. That was an early stage of the season as well that my data came from. Maybe the coach was trying to sort of coordinate the team and saw the best way to do that was to enact greater control over the governance to get everything set up. But a flatter hierarchy is a cultural decision, and it is one that coaches can enact by reshaping their language.
Hmm. Can we stay on the pitch for a moment and ask, I'd love for you to tell us a bit about the pre-match huddle, which is the bit I was talking about right at the beginning of the kind of, we've probably seen this, but don't really know what's happening. So can you take us quite literally inside the pre-match huddle? What is happening and how are ideas of solidarity being created?
Yeah, so I'm going to, just to be completely upfront, Miranda, my take on the pre-match huddle is going to be so boring and dull because Hollywood has made these things, you know, so poignant and powerful and, you know, people sort of opening up and talking. I'm just thinking about a couple of the movies that I've seen. Any Given Sunday is one where you have these pre-match huddles where you've got this coach sort of pouring their heart out about how they've gambled all their money away and they've broken up every relationship that they've ever had. And, you know, my huddles were very different and much more, in a linguistic sense, quite mundane and plain. And that's not to say they weren't any more, any less powerful, but the features that I'm going to highlight here weren't necessarily of this very Hollywood style. I'm not going to be able to talk about these big eloquent speeches where people are, their attitudes are shifted and changed. Really what we're talking about, some really mundane linguistic practices that establish a sort of a solidarity between individuals. Now, some of that stuff's done non-linguistically. You know, all the players are wearing the same playing uniform. They're all co-present physically in the same space. They're usually interlocked with arms. So they're sort of creating this huddle, which is a boundary. Everyone on the that isn't in the huddle is on the outside. So they're sort of creating a connected group. They're also in a restricted space, usually in a stadium changing room. No one else can get in there. So a lot of those features sort of lean solidarity to the event that they're engaged in. But communicatively, there were features like you saw the captain who would lead the huddles establishing a shared purpose through their talk. So constantly reminding the group of the shared purpose, constantly establishing a shared emotional pulse about how we're feeling about this environment. There's a lot of nervous individuals about to go on and play a professional match. So the captain's role was trying to build a shared emotional pulse amongst the group as well. Pronouns were really significant. So there was a lot of pronouns that were used to construct the group together, as together and togetherness. A lot of familiarizers as well that sort of showed that there were there was less of a social distance between the groups. There was a lot of active reducing of potential divisions in the team. So teams are made up of subgroups of individuals, some experienced, some inexperienced, some there for the first time, some of different ethnicities. So a lot of the work that was being done in the huddles in my data was being done to reduce any perceived divisions in the team and create a unity. And there was another, you know, really mundane linguistic feature, these sort of question tags, things like A and ha, and have you got it? Is that right? These sorts of things were working to sort of create involvement in the pre-match huddle. So it wasn't just one person addressing everyone. There's lots of question tags, but sort of requiring the players to get involved in the performance of this pre-match huddle. And then, of course, the one that everyone knows is these team chants, you know, these things that are only known by the team. And you know, you need to perform these team chants to show that you belong as well. So that's an array of taken-for-granted linguistic practices that I guess characterise the pre-match huddle as a solidarity event. Certainly very different to the pre-match speeches in Any Given Sunday and other Hollywood-type interactions.
Well, staying on this one for a moment, you gave us some helpful examples of kind of the idea of the hey, the A, right, that create engagement. The familiarizers and the linguistic features being used to flatten out or balance out divisions or potential divisions within the team. Can you give us some examples of those?
Yeah, so most of it was around identifying who the different people were in the team environment. And in this particular team environment, the data I collected, there were a lot of, I guess what you'd call rookies or first season players.
Yep.
And there was something that came through in the talk of the captain a lot in these pre-match huddles was about ensuring that these players were not perceived of as lesser individuals compared to more experienced individuals. Now, that might not have been the case, but the captain wanted to labour that point and make it very clear that they were a group together regardless of their backgrounds, and that it was up to the senior players to also engage and acculturate the younger players. And all that was conveyed at a time that's really significant for a team, just as they're about to go onto the field. That might have been done to try and motivate or alleviate any fears that the young players might have had about playing their first game or playing their first couple of games, showing that they were part of a bigger group now and that they had teammates that were there to look after them. So a lot of that was done through those sorts of trying to actually identify the potential divisions and flatten them out in these speeches. There was a lot of collective familiariser terms like boys and guys. This was a male team. So those were used a lot too to try and unify everyone and treat them and use these sort of very informal tokens for tokens of terms of address for grouping people together. So those are probably some of the main examples of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's very helpful. Thank you for adding those in. Mm. Given all of those different features used to create solidarity amongst the players, is that the only time we see solidarity? Can coaches have solidarity with players? Do they want to have solidarity with players?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting point. And I do talk about this in one chapter because I think the data really, it sort of threw up some questions for me in that particular area. I saw evidence of coaches trying to build solidarity with players through things that we might expect to see in sort of interactions, relationships where there's less social distance. So humour was a really, really probably the most frequent resource that we saw. So we saw instances where coaches would joke with players, for example, and that sort of suggests that there's a degree of closeness between the individuals. We tend to joke more with those people that we have closer relationships with, because jokes can go badly and they can be perceived in ways that we might not expect, especially if we deliver them to somebody that we don't have an established relationship with. So humour jumped out at me as one of those features that might suggest that coaches and players can build solidarity. The data seemed to suggest that most of the humour took on quite a teasing kind, which, humour takes on many different forms and performs many different functions. Teasing as one of those forms of functions sort of establishes more social distance between the individuals, sort of establishes the individual who is doing the teasing as the one in power and control. So I got really mixed picture here with regards to how solidarity was being built or at least attempted between the coaches and the players. I think the thing that really shone through with coach-player interactions was the coaches wanted to maintain, if we take my data as evidence in this particular case, wanted to really maintain control over the environment. That was the main aspect of the relationship that they had with the players. If that's the case, then solidarity potentially creates a bit of a problem for that type of relationship dynamic, because if you have too much familiarity, it may make things like giving instructions and giving negative assessments of performance a little bit harder to do. These coaches also need to make decisions about who plays and who doesn't play, and that's a really difficult decision, I'm sure, for many coaches as well, because that means disappointing certain individuals. If you are building too much solidarity with the players and maybe building those relationships so they're super close, it may create difficulty for being able to perform some of these more organizational, operational type decisions. So that's not to say that some sort of closeness is not valued, because there was certainly some evidence of that in coach-player interactions. I think one way to potentially sum it up is that I think coaches were friendly but not necessarily friends with the players. And it may be that that varies from context to context. There may be other contexts where coaches take a very different approach and seek ways to build, you know, large amounts of solidarity with their players. The language patterns would be different in those situations. There may be different features of those interactions, but certainly in my data, it was sort of, I guess the social norm was be friendly, but not friends.
Yeah, no, that makes sense and is a very interesting finding. Going back to a point that we both mentioned at the beginning, kind of now that we've gone through some of the things you found, as you mentioned, this research very much sort of evolved, right? You had to get into these interactions to kind of see what was happening in order to be able to do this analysis. Is there anything that you came across in this process that really surprised you?
Well, I think it's a really boring answer, Miranda, but everything surprised me. I think one of the best things you can do as a sociolinguist going into an environment is to try and go in as blind as you can, so everything seems magical and mystical and worthy of exploring. Because if you don't, then you miss some of the very mundane ways in which the very mundane building blocks of cultures, environments, and relationships. So you try to go in completely blind. I think if I'm really honest, I think, and I don't know, there may be social theorists out there who are interested in these sorts of issues. I think as a New Zealander, the idea of control and egalitarianism and things like this are quite interesting, and they didn't seem to necessarily be on show as much as I thought they might have been in a New Zealand rugby team. Now, that might be down to a lot of things, and certainly by saying that, I'm not saying it's wrong. It was just certainly potentially a little surprising that there was quite a strong degree of control enacted over the team environment. And, you know, so I think that was probably the most surprising thing. I think in New Zealand, egalitarianism is still a value, and it's sort of like we're all in this together, we all have a voice, we're all contributing, we all belong. But maybe at this stage of the season where I collected my data, it was more important to get processes in place to build sort of an operational language, to create structure in the environment. And, you know, maybe at a later stage in the season, some of that egalitarianism value maybe emerged a little bit more.
Still very interesting to think about. So thank you for sharing that. Moving, I suppose, from your perception doing all of this, kind of now that you're at the other end and the book is available and out there and people can go read it, what do you hope readers take from it?
So when I wrote this book, I wrote it for two different audiences, and I didn't realize at the time when I sort of set this mission that would be a borderline impossible task. I'd kind of wanted this to contribute to a really small but growing scholarship of language use in sports, high-performance sports contexts, you know, with the idea of hopefully starting to advance linguistics as a toolkit that theorists and sports practitioners could draw on to address and explore and unpack social dynamic issues in sports teams. So for the academic audiences, I wanted them to really sort of have an illustration of how language was being used in sports teams, and to be able to use that as the basis for explorations in different contexts, because I only looked at one context, and, you know, that's a limitation of qualitative research is that usually you go in and you go deep and you try to really understand what's going on in that context. The way that knowledge really moves forward is when multiple individuals take that agenda into multiple contexts and we can start to compare and contrast. So from an academic side of things, I really wanted to bring some visibility as to what was happening in this particular social environment with regards to language. And there was a lot of really interesting comparisons to be drawn around, say, educational settings there, teaching, hospital settings, and settings where there are, additional notional power structures in play. But I tried to also write it in an accessible way for a practitioner audience as well, who've got a lot of questions about language. This added another year to the book writing mission. So I finished it and then I thought, all right, I'll just tidy it up and, get it in a state that practitioners can engage with it. I worked really hard on that, and next thing I know, a year's gone and I still hadn't finished. And I had the publisher breathing down my neck saying, are you actually going to finish this thing? But what I mean, that effort, a couple of reviews of the book suggest that it's really achieved that mission, because I think one of the things that I'm finding about sort of sports practitioner understandings of language is it's quite limited, and that they would really benefit from a closer, more in-depth understanding of what language is, how it makes meaning, how significant and interconnected it is to things like identity and relationships and culture environments. So I think for that audience, I really hope they, if they do engage with the book and read it, that they walk away with an increased capability to be able to connect language practices and teams to bigger social phenomena like identities, relationships, environments, culture, things like that.
Hmm. No, I think those are some really interesting takeaways. And thank you as well for the insight into the process of coming up with them for the different audiences. Mm-hmm. The book is obviously out. So is there anything you've been working on since then or looking to work on, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this exact topic, that you'd like to take this final moment to highlight?
Yeah, I've just finished another book, an edited volume together with a colleague, Professor Stephanie Schnur at the University of Warwick as well. We looked at the language of inclusion and exclusion in sport. And that was a collection of chapters from scholars who are interested in this social practice of using language. And we asked authors to write chapters that highlighted how language was being used to create inclusion and inadvertently in some cases exclusion. So it could shine a light on those pieces of the puzzle, because inclusion is so significant for sport, whether it's professional or amateur. So we really wanted to shine a light and start really asking some questions in that particular space. So that book is also out. I recommend people looking at that. I've done a few other projects. I mean, the really lucky thing, I guess, for me is that I did this book and it's led from one thing to another, to another, to another. So I did a project with England Boxing after this book where we looked at the language and the 1 minute break between rounds. You get this sort of boxers out there in a boxing ring fighting another boxer for 3 minutes, and they come back to the corner and talk to the coach for a minute. It's more like 45 seconds. What on earth can you achieve in 45 seconds with a breathless boxer? So we looked at that question. And then that led to a project with a Formula One team looking at decision making under pressure and decision making communication. And then that's led to another project with the Football Association of Wales looking at how coaches and analysts communicate during live football matches. And hopefully in the future, I'm going to get back into rugby with a project that will put gender front and center as well. So language and gender is another area that sociolinguists and discourse analysts are really interested in exploring, and so hopefully we'll get the funding to explore that project too.
Well, best of luck with that, and thank you for sharing those snapshots of very fascinating sounding projects that very much relate to the book we've been discussing. For anyone who wants to read the whole thing, the title is How Language Shapes Relationships in Professional Sports Teams, and it's published by Bloomsbury. Kieran, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
No problem. Thank you for having me, Miranda.